Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday the 28th of April and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor from the Construction Index magazine and Phil Bishop, editor of our online news service at theconstructionindex.co.uk. Hi there, Phil, how are you doing?
Hello, David. I'm very excited. I'm getting my second COVID jab tomorrow.
Oh, are you?
More to celebrate.
You're ahead of me then.
Yay.
You're ahead of me. I don't even know when I'm getting my next one.
But no, all good. All good.
Good.
Anyway, should we kick on?
Well, we've got a packed programme today with...
We have.
Not one, not two, but three guests. Zoom willing, that is. So, so we've got no time to waste. So without further ado, let's introduce our first guest. Back in January, we discussed the Construction Product Association's proposals to introduce a new Code of Construction Product Information. It came out of the Grenfell disaster and the report on that, where it was quite clear that there was some, let's say, people being economic with the truth about their product information. It was not reliable. It was not truthful. The whole story has yet to come out, of course. So the CPA responded by proposing this code for construction product information. And the idea was that the marketing departments of all the product manufacturers would be a little bit more circumspect about the claims they were making and that they would back them up with facts and all the rest of it. And we were generally in favour of this idea. We discussed it on the podcast back in January.
We thought it seemed quite reasonable, didn't we?
I was particularly approving of the idea, and everything was hunky-dory, and the industry seemed to respond in a similar vein. And then along comes a chap called Darren Lester, founder and chief executive of Specified by an online products database, who poured cold water on all this, came up with some very persuasive arguments why this was not such a great idea, and in fact, how it might even make the whole situation worse. Well, that knocked the wind out of our sails, but we are very lucky to have Darren with us today on the podcast to explain about some of the pitfalls, some of the shortcomings of this proposal, and why he thinks it's not such a great idea. So, Darren, first of all, thanks for coming on the podcast and explaining this to us. Maybe you'd like to kick off by saying what your initial thoughts were when you first heard about this CPA proposal. Did you also think that it was a good idea to begin with?
So, first of all, thank you very much for having me on to speak about this. I appreciate it. There's a few parts to this. So I think we kind of have to separate the actual solution, the code itself, and the need to do something, which I think a lot of people aren't doing. So I don't think, certainly myself, I don't think anyone disagrees that there's a need to do something. I think the issue just is that the something that we've got, there's lots of flaws and lots of issues and lots of reasons why a lot of people, myself included, think that it's maybe not the best way to go and actually could, as you mentioned, potentially make things worse. So I think like my first reaction when I seen it was, you know, this is the typical, I would say the typical construction industry trade association type response to everything, which is to create a kind of a new badge that you acquire through a box ticking exercise. And so it just felt that it really was going to fall short in terms of, mm-hmm. of what was needed to actually address the underlying problems. And I would just say it goes back further than this. So I raised concerns about the initial research that was carried out into this in 2019. That ultimately led to the code. So I think the problems kind of started there, mm-hmm. and has led us to a solution that actually doesn't address any of the problems at all.
If I remember rightly, well, I know that the code includes 11 clauses, 11 basic clauses, all of which sound fairly sort of motherhood and apple pie. You can't really disagree with them. Things like do not use misleading or ambiguous wording, phrasing or imagery, and embrace the use of plain English to ensure accurate representation of product information and performance claims. Or another one was provide specific information where claiming compliance to or achievement of any certification, classification or industry standard. I mean, there appears to be nothing wrong with that on the face of it, but clearly you see some significant shortcomings. I just wonder where exactly those are. I mean, what do you think the problem is with this?
I think you're right to say, you know, if you go through the individual clauses of the code, there's nothing in there that you would say, oh, that's a ridiculous thing to do. And in fact, quite the opposite. Like, most of it is all very much common sense and to a certain extent, things that I think the general public would reasonably assume already happens. So this is kind of actually where the issue comes from. So if the code was just a thing that just developed out of the industry wanting to improve, then probably no one would bat an eyelid, and you can say, you know, okay, that'll potentially make things a little bit better, at least won't hurt, let's do it. But all of this, as you touched on, is in the context of Grenfell and in the context of the role that product manufacturers played in Grenfell happening. And this code is the construction product sector's collective response to that. How do we stop the construction product sector contributing to another Grenfell? And in that light, in that context, all of these things ultimately don't address the underlying problems. The underlying problems that we've got is that there's lots of them, but, you know, things like how is product data actually verified and validated? How do you control in any way what just an individual person tells somebody what a product can do or can't do? And there's all of these things, even just like the language that we use, how one company describes something versus how another company describes it, and that kind of lack of standardization. And essentially that there's a whole list of these things and others that came out in that initial research in 2019 that just aren't being addressed at all in the code. Like the code for me is very much, rather than a group of people who sat down to say, how do we stop the construction product sector contributing to another Grenfell, they sat down and they said, how do we repair our reputation off the back of Grenfell? Let's come up with a code and a badge, and so we can sort of showcase to everyone how much integrity we've got. And I just think that's leading us down the wrong path.
So they're answering the wrong questions, you think?
Yeah, I think somewhere along the way, and if you go through the report itself, if you go through the website for this, all of the language, and I think I posted something about this a while ago, I think that there's zero references to public safety in that, and there's about 20 references to the sector's reputation, the sector's integrity, you know, how the sector is viewed by the public. So to me, somewhere along the lines, you know, in this process, that focus has switched from the point of this is to protect the public, to make buildings safer. The point is not to repair any damage to the construction product sector's reputation because of Grenfell. You know, that should be achieved through a long-term improvement of how we do things, not just sticking a badge on it and saying, look, you know, we've now got integrity.
And I've read that you think it's actually going to make the situation worse, this code. Why is that?
I think potentially, yes. I think there's a couple of things. One, I don't think it's going to work. Like, regardless of whether it gets pushed through and the CPA do it or whatever else, I think it's going to be one of these things that it'll die a slow death. It'll die of a thousand cuts. Like, people are picking it apart in the detail, and it'll not get traction, and we'll waste collectively the next 12, 18 months before it's confirmed this hasn't worked, we need something else. And so essentially we'll have wasted 18 months not coming up with the right solution and the right answers because of this distraction. But so that's one part of it. I think the other part, which is potentially even more dangerous, is, you know, we have this kind of process where, and we all know these types of like business process, you know, badges and certifications, where basically once per year in an audit, everyone scrambles around to do what they need to do to get to pass and to get their badge, to get their certificate. And then the rest of the time, the rest of the year, they go back to doing, you know, the way they normally do things. So what we're going to have potentially here is, and I would say, you know, I know a lot of companies and the majority of construction product companies actually aren't doing anything wrong. But I think a process like this makes the companies that maybe are doing things wrong, and some have been highlighted to have been doing that, I think it would make it very easy for them to acquire this badge that says, look, you can trust us, you can trust our information, you can trust what we're telling you because we've got this, you know, we comply to this code. Mm. And then, you know, does that potentially create actually more risk where specifiers, people that are actually using the product information and making decisions about products, just take all of that at face value and don't actually scrutinize it and maybe mm-hmm. don't, you know, run the checks and balances that they should because of this badge? So I think that's a real risk that it essentially just plasters over some of the issues.
It sort of gives them a smoke screen to sort of to hide behind, doesn't it? They can,
yeah.
I think they say easily. we've got this code, people might just say, okay, then they're working to this code, therefore we can rely on what they say. Whereas nobody's checked whether or not they're sticking to the code to the letter, so they could be just saying we're doing this and they're not doing it at all.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
What's your dog in the fight? I mean, specified by your business, you're not a product manufacturer. You are clearly well informed and very much moved by the whole subject. Why? What's your business's personal position in all of this?
So I would say I don't have, you know, I don't have a dog in the fight. I think it's more just that, you know, this is the sector, this is the industry broadly in terms of construction, but, you know, more specifically the construction product sector, the specification side of things, you know, that's the kind of the sector, the area that I personally and my business are associated with. And I just feel like, you know, on this particular topic, we've got a situation where essentially everyone's watching. Like everyone is looking to see how does the construction product sector and the construction industry in general respond to, you know, to this disaster and make sure it doesn't happen again. And for me personally, I just don't want to be in a position where, you know, fingers crossed it doesn't, but let's say something similar happens in another few years and the questions will inevitably be, what did your sector do as an industry? What did you do to make this better, to change this? And so for me, I just feel like, you know, this thing was being pushed through. I think I said I spotted some issues early on, or things that I thought were issues early on in the process, and engaged with the Construction Product Association on that and raised the concerns, but they were dismissed. So I've kind of, I guess, kept an eye on it since then. And then there was a few things then once this actually came out that really worried me, that I would say, you know, prompted me to be more outspoken about it. And that was, you know, obviously the code itself and just me seeing the potential or the issues that I see with it. But also that the Construction Products Association said, and they've said this a few times, that they will push this through regardless. You know, they're doing an industry consultation, but they did not want to hear that this was a bad idea. They only wanted to hear how to tweak it and make it better. And I just thought that's a very, very dangerous stance for anyone to take on an idea that they've already decided this is correct and the right way to go, regardless of industry feedback. So I just don't think that's right. Mm.
Are you,
and I think
Sorry, Dan. Sorry. I was going to say, are you a lone voice here, or have you heard other people voice similar concerns?
No, I think, you know, despite the narrative that the CPA are pushing out, I do think actually the majority of people that are engaging with this don't think it's a great solution. I think at best a lot of people are in the camp of, you know, it's better than nothing, let's do it and try to make the best of it, but they maybe haven't thought about the risks of doing that, the risks of doing the wrong thing. So I definitely don't think I'm a lone voice, and I think, you know, the likes of the IET wrote a letter to the CPA.
IET?
Yeah, the Institute for Engineering and Technology, I think it is.
Okay.
So they wrote a letter to the CPA to raise their concerns with it. There's been a few, you know, webinars and different sessions to discuss it where there's been a lot of, you know, a lot of people, I sort of mentioned, you know, it potentially dying by a thousand cuts. Like a lot of people picking out sort of the different clauses and the details and, you know, that's not practical and how do you do that and that sort of thing. So I think there's definitely a lot of issues and a lot of resistance being raised with it. But, you know, just in the last couple of days, you know, the narrative has been that the feedback is amazing and, you know, only 1% or 2% of people think it's a bad idea. And that's not what I see. And there's lots of other people I think would agree with that.
So what's the answer? What should they do?
What I would do is I would essentially go back to the start. I would redo the research, the initial research that they've done into, you know, really understanding the root causes. You know, how did we actually get to this position? What are the other risks that could, you know, lead to similar things happening again? Because the initial research done into it wasn't thorough. You know, there's an independent report that's been published on that that analyzed it, and an independent research expert essentially pointed that out. So I would go back to that. I would do the research. I think there needs to be a broader group of people involved in terms of coming up with a solution. So, you know, with the greatest respect to all the people involved in it, it was a small group of pretty much all representatives of construction product manufacturers and pretty much all from a marketing background. Now, whilst their input is obviously needed in this and it's part of it, to me, there should have been a broad range of, you know, the end users of information in terms of specifiers, you know, data experts, standards experts, digital technology experts, behavioral change experts, because there's a big behavioral kind of cultural thing here as well. Like, I just think a broader set of opinions, you know, putting their minds to try and solve these problems, you know, once we've actually identified what are the real root causes. Because I don't think, you know, if it's essentially we take the code as it is, essentially that suggests that the root cause of the issue is the processes at product manufacturers in terms of how they manage information. I think that there are problems there, but it's not the only part of it. So I think fundamentally understanding the root causes is the first thing. Mm. And then, you know, the right people sort of working on this to come up with a solution.
Right.
I have one final question. Do you think you can win the argument?
I don't think the Construction Product Association are listening. I don't think they're taking on board the feedback from myself and others. I think for whatever reason that they are determined to push this through. I think they're under pressure to do something, to be seen to do something, and that's maybe clouding their judgment. But ultimately, whether I can sort of win this argument or not, or collectively the people that see this as a bad idea can win the argument or not, I don't know. But, you know, as I mentioned before, I think ultimately what's going to happen is it won't work is where we'll end up. And it's just a question of, do we acknowledge or at least consider that an option and try to address it now? Or do we wait 18 months, and we all waste 18 months to come to that conclusion. So I would hope at the very least that the CPA can see that it's in everyone's benefits to at least explore maybe why some of these concerns are being raised and try to address them, and maybe try to consider what other alternatives there may be that get ultimately everyone where we want to be, which is that this sort of thing doesn't happen again.
I hope the CPA is listening, and if there's an outside chance that they might be listening to this, that they get in touch with us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk and let us know why they haven't been listening to you and why your arguments aren't cutting any ice with them. So it'll be interesting to hear their view.
Darren, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, Phil, we have two more guests waiting for us. I'm very excited to introduce them. Let's get straight into it. We've got Dr. Benoit Jones, who's the Managing Director of InBuy Engineering, civil engineering company, and also Nancy Kerr, who isn't a civil engineer. She's actually a folk singer, composer, and teacher. And how do they come together? Well, I think probably the best way to introduce that is to ask Benoit to explain it. Why have we got
Benoit,
you?
Benoit, what the hell is Nancy doing on this podcast?
Well, as the civil engineer, I should explain. So I'm on the committee of the British Tunnelling Society, and it's our 50th anniversary year this year, and we had various plans for celebrating it, one of which is to produce a commemorative book, which hopefully will come out later this year, and it's full of stories about tunnelling from all our members and the wider industry. So we felt it really important to kind of try and tell these stories, and not just of the last 50 years of our society, but the whole of sort of British tunnelling history, or worldwide tunnelling history even. So I had this idea that we could have a folk song written. And at the time I thought, oh, you know, just one song would be amazing. And I proposed it to the committee, and they said, they thought it was a great idea. So I, top of my list was Nancy Kerr. And so I went to Nancy Kerr and said, could you write us a folk song? And she said, oh, I could do you a whole suite. So so that's how it started. And then Nancy did all the hard work after that, really.
So Ben Benoit, why Nancy? I mean, are you a big folk fan anyway? I mean, have you always been interested in folk music?
Yes, but I wouldn't say I'm a folk aficionado of any kind. I do like folk music, but I don't know that much about it. But the little I do know is that probably the best composer of folk songs is Nancy Kerr. And so that's why she was top of the list, really.
Okay, fine. So Nancy, you really ran with it, didn't you? You, as Benoit says, he asked you for one song. You gave him five. What was it about this commission that inspired you to go above and beyond?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, as you'll, you know, maybe appreciate, you know, in 2020, when Benoit and the BTS commissioned this material, my industry, of course, was sort of all but going under. You know, those of us who have played music for our living, and as I did, played many, many concerts, sometimes kind of 150 or more concerts a year, suddenly, you know, we saw our kind of industry changing and having to change, and saw the landscape of our kind of creative work really reduced. And so, you know, maybe you can imagine what a gift this is to be approached to write new music, you know, and to kind of respond and to use my kind of creative energy to tell these stories. So in that way, it was a huge gift. And we can talk a bit as we go maybe about why folk music, you know, and why it kind of made sense. When Benoit asked me. But I will say as well, another huge gift, and the reason why I ended up running with it and writing, you know, I think it's four songs and a piece of instrumental music as well. The real gift was the stories from people in, you know, the tunneling industry who gave their memories and their memoirs and their interviews to the upcoming book, the 50th anniversary book about the British Tunneling Society. And that is, as I keep saying, a gift to a songwriter. I think that the way that people talk about their own work and their own industry, and also their own community, the way people kind of describe their friends and family and the challenges of their work, and how they all kind of work together, it's poetry before you even put it into song. So in some ways, I think once I got kind of hooked on those ideas, and also I have to say the kind of, you know, the kind of romanticism as well of the sort of origin stories of some of the, you know, the kind of huge leaps of civil engineering and of invention and innovation. It's all a gift to a writer. So it felt like just kind of good sense to, as you say, run with it and create more than one piece and create a bunch of kind of different ways of amplifying these, you know, these amazing people's stories.
There's quite a tradition, actually, isn't there, of folk music commemorating the work and the lives of construction workers. I mean, it might sound a bit strange, but I mean, I can think of, well, McAlpine's Fusiliers, you know,
yes,
the song.
Absolutely.
Which was all about the Irish construction workers coming over after the war and rebuilding London, famously
so
recorded by the Dubliners. So you're following in a long tradition.
I want to chip in with Woody Guthrie in Grand Coulee Dam, which was a commission from a power company.
Yep.
Was it? I didn't realise that.
There's a folk song, one of my big spring-off points for this, and one of the reasons why when Benoit said, do you want to do this? I kind of went, I'm definitely up for doing this, is a song called Tunnel Tigers, which was written by Ewan McColl, who is from Salford in Manchester, also wrote Dirty Old Town and The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face. So he wrote Tunnel Tigers, which very much situates, you know, the experience of the Donegal or the, you know, the Irish migrant worker coming to London to dig, I think, particularly the Victoria Line, but like lots of kind of London infrastructure. So he, you know, that is in our, it's exactly as you say, it's in our knowledge of the last kind of however many years since before the Industrial Revolution when we have sung about our work. And that's, I feel like Benoit, although he says, you know, I'm no aficionado about folk, I feel like there was a really deep understanding when Benoit said, as I say, like, can you make these stories into music? I feel like he really got that. And it was really nice to hear that from him, and also to like to hear kind of requests that were really built in to folk and what folk can do. Like, folk isn't the only music that tells stories of construction and stories of industry and innovation, but it does do it very well, and it does do it in a certain way. So Benoit would say to me, look, you know, can you do a song where everyone can join in? Or could you do a song that people could easily learn and sing together? Or could you do a song that could be taught to children so they could learn about our industry?
Folk does that
very well, yeah.
I did get the clear impression that Getting a Rise was written specifically to be sung at the end of a very boozy British Tunnelling Society dinner.
Perfect. Isn't that funny? Because that was the children's song. So there you go. There's one verse that we'd probably leave out if we were teaching it to kids. But yeah, do you know what? That's a shanty. That's the thing. Yeah. And shanties are very now, but they've
very
also
now.
Been around for a very long time, you know.
Point, yeah.
So that works well as a kind of pattern for absolutely getting people to sing. And also that song is full of that gorgeous, you know, banter and camaraderie of those men and those workers. So yeah, glorious. That was some of the most fun I had was turning that song into something.
Good. Well, did you know much about tunneling before you were approached by Benoit?
Not so much, no. Again, mainly because of that song. I mean, I think a lot of us learn a lot from songs. Like, songs do tell us stuff. So Tunnel Tigers, you know, I knew kind of what the... I think I knew what the kind of socioeconomic and what the kind of cultural backgrounds of some tunnellers was. Mm-hmm. I also... My stepfather, I have to say, is an engineer, not a tunneller, but he very quickly, when he knew I was doing this, he sent me Rolt's book on Brunel, and so I kind of soaked that up, and we're a canal family. I lived on a boat for 12 years, and we all have canal boats. So it's kind of in there, but this definitely brought it out. And I feel like I've really got into those kind of aspects. I mean, I think one connection, a really strong connection regardless of like the specifics of industry, one of the big connections is place. So, and there were two really big parts of that for me. One was Dartford, like a lot of my family are from Kent and are, you know, migrant workers to Kent. So, and I've been through the Dartford Tunnel a billion times as a touring musician. So I found, you know, Forget and Arise, I found those narratives really powerful. But I also, my father was from the Northeast, was a miner's son. And so that kind of co-opting and sharing of the language of mining, of collieries, into kind of the similar kind of taking on of that, you know, that incredible strength and identity of community. And the way that a lot of people come from mining traditions to go into physical kind of tunnelling. That was kind of lots that I drew on, you know. And again, from song, we learn such a lot through song. So I'm very grateful. But it was lovely. There's nothing like hearing those stories from the person who has lived it. You know, that's the main privilege.
We are going to hear a brief snatch of one
of
your songs.
Right.
And
great.
Phil, which song in particular did you want to
My Sweet Trailer, the first one. I just think that's absolutely beautiful, that one. I had to Google what a trailer was. Benoit, is that a term, an animal that tunnellers use? Did that come from you, or was that Nancy's imagination? Because I discovered that it was a worm that lives inside its own tunnel that it creates. Is that your metaphor?
I didn't tell Nancy about this. She read it in Rolt's book, I imagine.
Read it in, Benoit, you sent me Jane Stancliffe's writing about the Thames Tunnel as well. So her sort of explanation was very well put. It was like he saw this inspiration from, you know, he got this inspiration from the natural world and he kind of ran with it. And then I went and looked it up in the book. And again, that's a massive gift to me. I've done a lot of sort of ecological and nature kind of work. So the idea of bringing nature and ecology and innovation together was quite delicious. It's very new. I understand. But that is a shield, right? That is the kind of...
Yes.
And it's such a lovely name. It's so attractive.
Teredo, yes. I had to look it up because I wasn't familiar with it. It's called a shipworm, but it's actually a mollusk.
Yeah, it's
and
a
it
mollusk,
burrows
yeah.
into timber, doesn't it? And it forms a tunnelling shield behind it.
Yeah.
And Mark Brunel saw this and he designed a cast iron version.
The shield, the idea of kind of... Sorry, go. Yeah.
So
go.
The shield was inspired by the Teredo.
Allegedly, that's how the narrative has developed. Yeah, that he was sort of looking at this thing that was... I mean, it's a pest. When I first wrote that song, I did kind of say... I played it to a friend of mine and I was like, I know this is a really romanticised vision of tunnelling, but it's also a very romanticised vision of, you know, seaborne pest. Yeah, exactly. It's all very romantic. Yeah. But yeah, as I understand it, you know, he's looking at that thing, that organism, and... When the organism eats its way into a ship, it doesn't get collapsed by the ship. It kind of makes its own strength. Yeah. And so as I understand it, that's the kind of... And I think that's hugely important because it's actually a valuing of the tunneler. It's a valuing of the worker, which, of course, you don't necessarily always see either in folk song or in industrial history. So it kind of... That did get me, partly because it's nature and partly because I can imagine myself, as I did in the song... in the character of, you know, a lover or a wife or a mother or a parent going, at least my person who is in that incredibly, you know, extreme situation. And the Thames Tunnel was hugely fraught. I mean, a lot of that narrative is massively tragic and you know, really brings the kind of death trap part of the work home. And yet you have then this kind of innovation which at least starts to save lives. I did want to say though, when I think we presented this when we did the Harding prize a couple of weeks ago for the British Tunnelling Society, and I talked about this song and we played it, and people were like, oh, we should have a Teredo and we should have a TBM based on a Teredo. But of course a Teredo is a male word, and lots of like machinery across industry and narrowboats are named after women, so they have to be like female names. So I think I might need to write another version of this song which is Teredo, so that it's got like a kind of female sort of, and that chips in with the kind of Brunel ship kind of vibe. But yeah, that's what the song kind of came from, and hopefully there's some truth in there, not just romanticism and snails.
On Dockland sand, our future's father surveyed a sunken ship, his hand upon its beam, some seaborne soul, some sweet to Rado, turned trusted oak to bone, turned oceans into dreams. That little friend, through great invention, grew to iron size below the river bed, now fortune fair and great to Rado. Keep the air above my minor laddie's head, I fear the stones below us rolling, shifting shale and industry, let life prevail. My sweet Teredo, keep him whole and bring my minor lad to me.
I have to say, I think the lyrics that you've written are really excellent. I mean, really poetic as well. Oh, and you're a musician foremostly, but you're also a very good lyric writer. But you include two short instrumental pieces here, which I really liked. They sounded a bit more Irish to me than English.
Intentionally, yes.
Yeah, they were. But they were called The Shipworm and The Shield. Now, clearly. Clear references here to what we've just been talking about. But were they original compositions?
They're original, but very much drawing on existing, you know, very ancient traditions from, as you say, from Irish sources. So a lot, I mean, Benoit said this to me, you know, lots of people come from Donegal, and I did sort of go to a lot of kind of social media and a lot of chat among the Donegal Tunnel Tigers just to kind of get a vibe for their language and how they relate, and there's lots of music there, and I'm not Irish, but my other half is Irish origin, and we play a lot of Irish music, and Donegal fiddle music is just, you know, primo stuff. So I based very much what I played on that. That's me playing fiddle, and I based it on what kind of music I imagined those people might bring in their heads, you know, when they migrate and work.
One of the things I love about this whole project, beyond even the music itself, is not just the way that you seem to have reflected and captured the sense of community which exists, generally in construction, but it seems to me, and Benoit can talk to this, I guess, the tunnelling subset of construction is a unique world of its own. It seems so much more tighter and close and I don't know what the gender-neutral term for brotherhood is, but it's more than community. It's brotherhood, sisterhood. It's that. Mm-hmm. And I suspect that while the way in which, Nancy, you've managed to capture and reflect this, it will be magnified back on the BTS and the tunnelling community and further, I think, strengthen and cement that sense of identity that they have.
Yeah, I think so. I don't have a lot of experience of other areas of civil engineering because I've always been in tunnelling for the last 20-odd years, but it certainly seems to be a very special part of civil engineering. You hear of a lot of people moving from other areas of civil engineering into tunnelling, but you don't hear of anyone leaving tunnelling to go build bridges or highways or buildings. You know, they just don't do it. Once you're in tunnelling, you're in tunnelling. You don't want to
leave. It gets in your blood, does it?
Mm. Yeah, I think so. And partly that's the sort of close-knit community you have. Mm. The BTS meets every month in normal times in the Institution of Civil Engineers in London. And, you know, we always have a talk in the Telford Theatre, but everyone goes to the bar afterwards. And, you know, we all have a pint or two and sausages and chips. They tried to remove our sausages and chips, and you wouldn't believe the uproar there was. So it's a very close-knit community. Well, and I think also the uniqueness is the close relationship between the engineers and the miners. Mm. And I don't think you see that in other parts of civil engineering. And the miners are very highly motivated and very professional and very highly trained. You can't fit that many people in there, so they have to be the best people you can find. And I remember my first job was Terminal 5 at Heathrow, and we had a whole bunch of tunnel miners, but also all the sort of above ground construction workers. And you could tell by the way someone walked across the yard whether they were one of the miners or not. You know, just the sense of purpose and professionalism that they had. It's a kind of different breed of people, really.
The Galacticos.
Yeah, and historically, it's, I mean, sometimes now a lot of the work involves pressing buttons in a TBM, but historically it involved a lot of very hard work. And these people were basically athletes. They could work a 12-hour shift, shoveling and working with heavy tools in incredibly hot and dusty, sometimes wet environments. Mm. And they could do that day after day. And there's not many people that could do that.
No.
One of the things I was very taken with, again, you say kind of, you know, general kind of construction sort of experiences and what they have in common. But I definitely felt that there was this kind of diver aspect as well to it, the kind of idea of being under pressure and underwater, and the way that the tunnelers were talking about what literal pressure they were under, but also, as you say, being so athletic and so... just so adept and so up for it as well, is that really came across in the memoirs and in the interviews, and that was amazing to be able to write about.
Yeah, you clearly did your research for this, Nancy, because your lyrics reference all sorts of things which I think people in the tunneling industry would immediately relate to, and you talk about specific projects like Tideway and Dartford.
Yeah.
And various other locations. You're clearly not just sort of saying it must be lovely to dig holes for a living. you're going into it in far more detail than that. You've really sort of got a feel for life as a tunneler, I think.
Well, I think that is what, if you want to write a folk song, that is sort of, in my mind, what you should try and do, because partly, like I said before, folk song really situates itself via place. So actually it's a very effective way to be able to connect with people, to say, you know, Tideway, or I said Medway in one of my songs, and I actually got a tweet from someone saying, listening to you sing about Medway made me really emotional, because that's a really important kind of river and project and region and idea, and it is for me too. So you really connect with people when you mention the specifics. Having said that, I'm sure I got stuff wrong, because, you know, I'm just a folk singer, so, you know, I'll enjoy being told what I got wrong, and I think that's part of the process.
Don't folk songs evolve over the years naturally anyway?
Yeah, well, people will get it exactly. They'll change it and get it wrong. That's the folk process. But also, maybe, I mean, there's a part of it that's like Benoit said about that, or Benoit kind of put in motion about the sort of joining in with the songs or learning them yourselves. If you were to go to the Bandcamp site where the album is, the album Tunnelers, it's just five tracks, and it's there. You can go and listen to it. If you were then to buy it, you actually get all the sheet music as well. You get all the scores. If you read music, or if not, you've got all the lyrics there. So the kind of idea that you might sing these songs, but also, why not put your own place names in it? Do you know what I mean? Why not put your own knowledge about that? So that, again, it's all about kind of just advancing those stories and telling them to a kind of wider audience. It was absolutely definite to try and get as much as I could write, to the degree of things like, I did say something like I had the TBM, and then I had to literally change it to the girls of the TBM and make sure that it was the right kind of terminology. There was a great piece that is in, I don't know if it's in the book, Benoit, or whether you just sent it to me, but the kind of language of miners and the kind of crack and the kind of coded language, like calling your wife the queer one at home and things like that. There's just gorgeous... you know, idiomatic, beautiful, poetic speech, which is how ordinary people speak every day. And it's a gift. It's lovely.
I have one final question, which is, when can people come and see and hear you play these songs?
That's a good question. That's a tricky one to ask because, as I say, my industry is still really trying to claw its way back to safe live performances. But I have to say, this project will be right at the top of my priority for trying to make a live thing happen. Don't you think, Benoit? I mean, we talked about possibilities for some kind of live launch and maybe a significant location or, but yeah, I'd be well up for that. So we will keep everyone posted. At the moment it's on Bandcamp and you can immerse and hear it, but I would love to do some kind of launch thing. Maybe people will join in, you know, maybe we'll get Tunnelers and Engineers singing along.
I think they'd love to.
Yeah, fantastic. I look forward to that.
Nancy, Benoit, thank you very much for joining us. As Nancy says, the Music is a Herb album or EP, Tunnelers, is available on her Bandcamp. You just Google Nancy Kerr Bandcamp Tunnelers, you'll find it. We've even got a link to it from the story we posted on the Construction Index. So to both of you, Benoit and Nancy, thank you very much for joining us. This is the most fun we've had on one of these podcasts. First time we'll be able to talk about something other than construction. Next week, we're going to get Rod Stewart. But for this week, thank you very much and goodbye.
Thanks guys.
A lot. Goodbye.
Thank you.
As I was going to Dartford all on a winter's day, those lads of Kent were downward sent with the pilot underway, and we were getting a rise with the TIEIO. We were getting a rise with the TIEIO. Well, we were feeling jammy, gone down to 8-hour shifts. Then the foreman cries, you'll be getting a rise every time you take the lift. And we were getting a rise with the TIEIO. We were getting a rise with the TIEIO. The crack was up to 90, but the foreman's face was drear. There's industry in the old country, but beggar all happening here. And we were getting a rise with the TIEIO. We were getting a rise with the TIEIO. And it's oh, the cruel compressor, and oh, the miner's moans, and oh, the shock of the medical lock when the wind gets in your bones. But we were getting a rise with the TIEIO. We were getting a rise with the TIEIO. Well, love can move a mountain, but we could shift the moon. We could travel to hell, then sleep so well that we wouldn't wake up till noon. And we were getting a rise with the TIEIO. We were getting a rise with the TIEIO. Well, some say digging's a lousy, but miners know it's grand. When you're down the hole, you'll bless the soul of a Dartford tunnelling man. And we were getting a rise with the TIEIO. We were getting a rise with the TIEIO.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.